You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
PRI's Studio 360 is made possible in part by a grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
It's a smaller scale works that create a whole world within these tiny little pictures.
When things are that tiny, you kind of get lost in it.
This is Studio 360 from WNYC in New York and Public Radio International. I'm Kurt Anderson. Today, musicians play with tiny sounds.
There's a lot you can do with a guitar and a drum set, and there's just as much you can do with a, you know, high sine wave and a low sine wave.
And the painter Shazia Sikander goes very, very small.
None of these pictures, whether they are 2 feet big or they are 2 inches big, were ever intended to be put on a wall.
My guest is the playwright David Ives.
Miniatures give you that feeling like you've just had your picture taken and the flashbulb has popped. Just for that 1 second, you feel absolutely alive.
That's all ahead in Studio 360, where art and real life collide. Remember the late 60s? Back then, for about 5 minutes, five thrilling minutes if you were young, rock and roll itself felt like a challenge to the man, as if it were the soundtrack to revolution.
Everywhere I hear the sound of marching Georgia feet, oh.
And in that insane, giddy, anarchic moment, stealing stuff was redefined as okay. Not just okay, romantic, countercultural, even revolutionary, as glorified in Abbie Hoffman's brilliantly titled book, Steal This Book. That zeitgeist reconfigured itself, as the zeitgeist always does. But 15 years later, in the mid-1980s, when the so-called digital revolution got underway, a distinct part of its ethos was also countercultural and utopian, particularly as embodied in the famous phrase, "information wants to be free." That line, by Stuart Brand, was generally misinterpreted as an exhortation that in the internet we finally had a blissful media anarchy where it costs nothing to read or watch or hear practically anything. And then, another 15 years after that, as the millennium was ending, the digital revolution achieved one of its apotheoses with the invention of so-called peer-to-peer file-sharing networks like Napster and Nutella and Kazaa. 100 million people around the world signed up almost instantly. It was free. And once on, they could find almost any piece of popular music ever recorded and then download a copy to their computer and play it forever for free.
Tell me, what can a poor boy do?
Countercultural utopia had finally arrived. And today, a large fraction of Americans, 10% or maybe even 20%, download songs. In fact, they download literally billions of songs a year for free. And since these days the man is a hepcat, even big companies are on board. For a while, Apple Computer had the groovy advertising slogan, "Rip, mix, burn." In other words, download music for free and make your own CDs at home. But not everybody thinks file sharing is so cool. The companies that make and sell the CDs and DVDs that everybody is downloading for free think it's shoplifting and think it may explain why CD sales have dropped 25% in the last 4 years. What finally forced me to focus on this subject is a court case. Last month, the Recording Industry Trade Association sent out 1,000 subpoenas seeking the names and email addresses of file sharers, regular people who download music without paying for it. The case grabbed my attention because, first, it seemed like the real beginning of the end for promiscuous file sharing. And second, because I've become a satisfied paying customer of Apple's nifty new download music store. And third, because I happen to be the father of two teenagers who like music and who spend half their waking hours online. So, do I think that Warner and Sony and the other record companies will actually sue millions of kids like mine listening to illegal copies of White Stripes and Fisher Spooner? Of course not. But the litigation did make me face up to the fact that all the rampant wink-winking about free file sharing won't really wash anymore. It really is copyright infringement on a vast scale, and our culture depends on copyrights being honored. I mean, wouldn't I feel a little cheated, as well as a little flattered, if people were handing out free photocopies of the books and articles that I write? The impossible dreams hatched in the late 60s were abandoned pretty quickly in the 1970s. Now, here in the aughts, it's time to wake up once and for all from the impossible dreams hatched in the late 90s. As my parents never tired of telling me when I was a kid, there's no such thing as a free lunch. This is Kurt Anderson in Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360, and it's time now for this week's cover story on miniatures. A miniature bit of tremendous power is the engine of our era, the computer microchip. Now, imagine that you're looking at part of a computer circuit through a microscope. There's a maze of what looks like tiny wires and pipes etched on an area no wider than a human hair. You adjust the microscope, and then you notice something else. There in the corner is the face of a baby, or a full-color hummingbird. Computer engineers aren't supposed to cut pictures onto chips. They do it secretly. They slip the tiny art into mass production and hope that someone someday will find it. Today we are talking about how small things fire the imagination. We mean small versions of big things, like dollhouses, and art that was conceived originally at a smaller scale, like the delightful plays written by my guest, David Ives. The New York Times has called David Ives the maestro of the short form. He is probably best known for his one-act comedies, including All in the Timing and Mere Mortals. David Ives, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you very much.
What is your attraction to working at the small scale of one acts and so on?
Well, I think it's because I used to write very large, ponderous, pretentious, magnificent existential plays that weren't very good. And at some point I realized that that was not the way I actually thought. And sometime in the mid-80s, I just started writing. One night I sat down with an idea I'd had for years and years, which was the age-old proverb that three monkeys sitting at three typewriters into infinity will at some point produce Hamlet. And so I started wondering what those monkeys would talk about while they were sitting at the typewriter. So I set them down and wrote a play called Words, 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 which was done to a good deal of notice. And somehow I was on my way, and I was just thinking small for a very long time and produced, I think, 28 or 29 of those little plays.
And certainly at that time, little plays, little one-acts, there was not an established appetite or structure for those. You sort of created a category.
You know, Lorca once said, a play is a poem standing on its feet. And I've always taken that to some serious length, I should say, or not length. And short plays just gave me the chance to kind of take a conceit or an image and explore it and crystallize a thought really dramatically. And it gives you a chance to pare things down to some sort of essential that I just enjoy in art in general.
We have a little bit of one of your little works that we would like to play. Can you tell us what we're going to hear?
This is a monologue that I wrote called A Singular Kind of Guy, which is about which is a man in a bar on a Saturday night wearing a sharp suit and some good shoes. And he has a very profound secret that he tells to the person that he's talking to.
I know what you're thinking. You're looking at me and you're saying to yourself, average guy, normal human being, nothing out of the ordinary. Well, that's what I thought too for lots of years, and boy, was I wrong. Now I look back, I think I always really knew the truth about myself underneath. It's like sometimes I'd look in the mirror in the morning and I'd get this weird feeling like what I was looking at was not what I really was looking at. Or else I'd be standing in a crowd of people at a party and suddenly I'd get this idea like I was standing in a huge empty space and there wasn't anybody around me for miles. Episodes of vastation, if you know that beautiful word. And then one day I had a, I don't know what you'd call it, a mystical experience. I was walking down Lex over in the 30s when I go by this office supply shop, just a crummy little place. But I turn and I look and I see an Olivetti Model 250 portable electric typewriter. Are you familiar with that particular model? Have you ever seen the old Olivetti 250? Well, let me tell you, it is sublime. The lines, the shape, the slant of the keyboard, it's all there. It's a thing of beauty. Anyway, I'm standing there looking at this thing, and it's like I recognize it from someplace. It's like I'm looking at family somehow, like I'm seeing some long-lost older brother for the first time, and suddenly I realize that's me right there. That thing in the window is exactly what I feel like on the inside. Same lines, same shape, same aesthetic. And what I realized was, I am a typewriter. No, really, a typewriter. All those years I thought I was a human being on the inside, I was really a portable Olivetti 250 with automatic correctability. And you know what? I can't even type. Needless to say, this revelation came as a shock. But all of a sudden, it's clear to me how come I always got off on big words like vastation or phenomenological or subcutaneous. Words are what a typewriter's all about, right? Problem is, it can be a lonely thing being a typewriter in a world of human beings. And now, here I am being replaced every day by word processors. Who needs a typewriter anymore? Here I finally figure out what I really am. I'm an antique already. Plus, there's my love life, which is problematical, to say the least. The difficulties involved in a typewriter finding a suitable partner in this town are fairly prodigious, as you can imagine. At least now I know how come I always loved not just sex. Sex is anywhere, but touch, being touched, and touching. Being touched is part of the nature and purpose of typewriters. That's how we express ourselves and the human person along with us. Hands on the keyboard and the right touch, fire away. Yeah, women's hands. They're practically the first thing I notice. Nice set of shapely fingers. Good manicure, no hangnails, soft skin. I'm not a finger fetishist or anything, you understand. It's just, you've got a pretty nice pair of hands yourself there. That's what I noticed. That's how come I stepped over here to talk to you. I know this all sounds pretty loony, but you know, I never told anybody this before. Somehow I just felt like I could trust you. And what? Beg your pardon? I don't understand. You're not really a girl? Sure you're a girl. You're a beautiful girl, so... You're what? You're actually a sheet of paper? 10-pound bond? Ivory tinted? Pure cotton fiber? Glad to meet you.
Well, that was lovely.
Oh, thank you.
And that represents how much of that play?
That is an entire play. That is one of the few monologues I've actually written as a self-standing piece. But it's a full love story, sort of in 3 minutes.
What can't you do when you're working at this very compressed, miniaturized scale?
Well, there's no time for realistic development, and so you, because you're stripped down to sort of essentials, you have to just be as concise as you possibly can. It is a form that lends itself to either poetry or philosophy. My favorite Beckett play is a play called Breath, which is it is literally this. The curtain comes up. The lights shine on a stage filled with rubbish for about 5 seconds. You hear a breath for about 10 seconds, and then the lights go down and the curtain falls, and that is the entire play. And there's something just so extraordinarily stark and yet so extraordinarily rich about that. And so it's that richness that I think short form allows you to explore without trying the patience of your audience, especially since most plays that I go to seem twice as long as they should.
Most things that one goes to. The word miniature has a set of connotations that aren't necessarily positive. How do you regard the miniature as a way to make art of various kinds?
Well, I think that miniatures are part of a sort of ancient argument in art, I guess sort of between the classical and the romantic in a funny way. I think it's always been odd to me that in Western poetry there is Homer and immediately thereafter there is Sappho, who wrote lyrics, brief lyrics, some of which only survive in one line or two lines, whereas Homer is the expansive sort of novelistic author who is not lyrical but epic. And I think that we have that same argument in American poetry between the sort of cataloging, all-inclusive, encyclopedic yowl of Whitman to the sort of absolutely gem-like little pieces by Dickinson.
And in fiction. I mean, Thomas Wolfe and Fitzgerald, The Great Gatsby, right. Is a tiny right. book, actually.
Miniatures in just about any art form, to me, give you that feeling like you've just had your picture taken and the flashbulb has popped and you have had some moment of extraordinary electric feeling, and for that 1 second you feel absolutely alive. I think that's what the really great miniatures do. It's that pound line, you know. Pound wrote the endless cantos, you know, which nobody reads anymore, but probably his greatest poem is the two-line poem called In the Station of the Paris Metro, which just goes, the apparition of these faces in the crowd, petals on a wet black bough. And that is perfection in poetry. You can't get any better than that, and it's greater than all of the 900 pages of his cantos, I believe.
David Ives is my guest today. I'm Kurt Anderson. In a minute, we'll hear about a tradition of Indian painting that tells grand stories with small pictures. That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360, and we are talking about miniatures. My guest is the playwright David Ives. Miniature paintings have been a part of lots of cultures, sometimes as an example of technical prowess and sometimes something more. In India, hundreds of years ago, miniature paintings served as a repository of political and social and spiritual meaning. They played a huge role in the official culture of the courts. Now there's an artist in New York City who has been using this genre again. Sarah Lilly has her story.
I recently almost left a cheek smear on a 450-year-old piece of art. But really, I had to. It was the only way I could get close enough. The painting was from northern India and insanely detailed, about 8 inches high and 6 inches wide. And there were many others of similar size and beauty.
In India, you can very clearly see that as early as in the 11th century, you have paintings on palm leaf, which are about 2 inches big.
Vishakha Desai is senior vice president of the Asia Society in New York City and an expert on the history of Indian miniature paintings.
that tradition is matured in the Islamic world, and particularly in Iran, and then it comes into India in the 16th century, especially during the Mughal period, which is the Muslim rulers of northern India. But it's fair to say that from the 16th through the 19th century, all over North India, this is really the painting of choice. You have it in Hindu courts, you have it in Muslim courts, you have it in the courts in between. The truth of the matter is that none of these pictures were ever intended to be put on a wall. These were meant to be really like books that you read in your hands. You cannot but get engaged with that work.
This explains the trouble of ripping myself away from the Hamzanama when it was on view at the Brooklyn Museum. The Hamzanama was essentially a storybook created in northern India in the 16th century, which featured over 1,400 images of eye-boggling detail. There are spectacular sword fights, giant ships, demons, sea monsters, and a three-eyed horse.
There is a lot of action, and you immediately say, oh yeah, I want to look at that.
The Mughal emperors commissioned countless miniature paintings from their atelier of court painters, and the genre was widely adored for hundreds of years. By the second half of the 20th century, however, a lot had happened. British colonialism, the 1947 partition between India and Pakistan, and people's attitudes towards the paintings had changed.
It was a familiar genre. One grew up sort of with it in a very estranged manner. It was a genre which was always considered very kitsch and done primarily for tourism and for tourists.
Shazia Sikander is an artist who grew up in Pakistan and has been living in the U.S. since the early 90s, when she graduated from art school in Lahore. At that time, she was nearly alone in her serious pursuit of miniature painting, and she was breaking ground with the very personal nature she was injecting into the genre. Since then, Sikander's works have continued that path with some truly mesmerizing details and juxtapositions. Vishakha Desai.
For Shazia, there are personal references, references to court paintings, veiled women, Buddha gestures, horses that actually are without heads. You have very specific references to the Western works, Botticelli's Venus and the big shell from which emerges a huge crocodile, and dancing figures, literally doing somersaults.
As you layer the pigment onto and you build the painting, you can burnish each layer. And this way you sometimes get a much more intense, almost like a jewel-like quality of color and pigment. For me, it's very important to build up layers from light to dark and to have really thin layers built up slowly, because that sort of, for me, I feel it always traps light.
Another feature of Sikander's work is the freedom with which she treats the highly detailed painted borders, which are so characteristic of traditional Indian court paintings. Sikander's central images often tumble out and into the borders, uncontained.
This very idea of exploding from the border out. For Shazia, there is a wonderful work, for example, that plays with the Hindu subject of Krishna and gopis that explodes into this Persianate landscape, and that in itself immediately makes you question the very idea of the kind of fault lines between Hindu-Muslim worlds that we have all otherwise seen in the political news. She is a contemporary artist who actually is doing something that's as much about her, about her existence in this life, as it is also about South Asian cultural traditions.
This marriage of tradition and modern life is bewitchingly executed in Sikander's latest work with computer animation. She recently introduced these new pieces at the Brent Sikkema Gallery in New York, where they were displayed on small monitors which were embedded in the wall and modestly framed. But the pieces still require the close attention of old.
A lot of people would look at the digital piece and kind of move on, thinking that that is also a painting. And it's only after you give it a few seconds that it actually starts to move and animate itself. It's a surprise, even for me as I'm creating it, but I enjoy that.
At one point within the work, a crowd of court ladies slowly fades into white, while their dark hair remains and begins to gradually churn in a gentle vortex.
They almost kind of like, for me, they emulate this kind of a dark energy.
These paintings operate with a stealth power of persuasion that's pretty formidable.
I personally have a problem with the term miniature.
It's a misnomer, because when we think about it, it somehow implies that it's a miniature version of something bigger. It is just simply that it's a smaller scale works that create a whole world within these tiny little pictures.
For me, you know, they are very intense. They carry a lot of information within them. That aspect is what really fascinates me about this work. I never think about them as small paintings. I always think of them as large.
For Studio 360, I'm Sarah Lilly.
You can see images of Shazia Sikander's work at studio360.org. I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360, talking today with the playwright David Ives about all sorts of miniature arts. David, do you like miniature paintings, Indian miniatures?
Actually, by a strange coincidence, I saw some of Sikander's work at the Whitney, I believe it was, three or four years ago. And when my wife and I had gone to see something entirely else, but it was her paintings that we ended up talking about as we left the place. They were just extraordinary because of that intensity that she talked about, and that the way that she managed to compress a little world into her within that very small frame. And they were just delectable. And one of the nice things is that it's not like Jackson Pollock or Rothko, where you've got 20 people crowded in front of it. Only one person can crowd in front of it at a time. And I think that quest for perfection, I think, is part of what she is after and what a lot of miniaturists are after, because there's no room to make a mistake in a work like that. You have to be really, really good. You can't – it's not like painting a 20-foot by 30-foot painting. You really have to make sure that every stroke counts. And that's partly why, for me, that kind of painting and her painting was so interesting, because it is an extraordinary vision – and great craftsmanship at the same time. And I also think that one of the virtues of paintings like hers and work in miniature is that it just makes you pay attention. I think that in a world of the short attention span, you actually have to look at it. And so that's why it may be an art for our time to sort of reawaken us, because we've gotten sort of lazy with large things. We don't have to pay attention. And so I admire people who don't let you off the hook. And miniatures, in a funny way, although they're shorter, do the opposite, because you have to work harder in order to sort of take them in and pay attention. It's like illuminated manuscripts or one of those books of hours from the Book of Hours of the Duc de Berry, where it's only 2 inches by 3 inches, and so you really have to bend over it and look. And so it is something exquisite and yet something enormous at the same time. And
which is why, as in her work, I suppose, so many religious traditions have had miniature artifacts as part of their, if not their liturgy, their cultural tradition.
Right. And I think that this is also that tradition that we had in the West in medieval times of small carvings, you know, very tiny carvings. The cloisters have some of them that are just extraordinary. I think there's a walnut shell-sized crucifixion at the cloisters. But that sort of compression of a very large event to something small shifts your perspective. And it's the shifting of perspective which is also part of the fascinating effect of these, of miniature art, really.
Historically, also, part of the reason for miniature paintings, and certainly in this country, has been the sheer portability of tiny little paintings. I recently was reading about the tradition of miniature portraits in America from about the mid-18th to the mid-19th century, and it's this entire genre, mostly watercolor on ivory, and counter to the idea that this is inherently spiritual or religious, my favorite one was one done by a painter named Sarah Goodridge, who was a miniaturist, for her lover, secret lover, I guess, Senator Daniel Webster. And she made a portrait of just her breasts on this 2-by-3-inch piece of ivory, which he apparently carried with him to the end of his days, which I, you know, that's enough of an argument for miniaturism right there.
Sort of a memento mammary, I guess.
David Ives is my guest today. I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360, and we are talking about miniatures. Before television and radio, lots of families used to gather around a 14-inch box that was set up on a stand or a table in their living rooms. They'd watch melodramas and action epics and romances even without electricity in the house. The box was a toy theater made of cardboard or wood, and it was an immensely popular item 100 and 150 years ago. Deborah Cash reports on the history of miniature stages and how some artists today have rediscovered them.
Ladies and gentlemen, the short, entertaining history of toy theater.
In the 19th century, the most popular home entertainment for upwardly mobile European families was toy theater. For less than the price of a theater ticket, families could buy and put together a cardboard scale model of, say, the Drury Lane Theater in London, and stage the hits of the day in their own homes, adding their own personal flourishes.
Well, back in the late 1700s, people would buy flat cutout versions, prints of the puppet.
John Bell is a puppeteer, actor, and theater historian. With the collectively run theater company Great Small Works, he's been at the forefront of the toy theater revival in the United States.
The toy theater printers, they'd hire an artist to go and sit in the front row, and the artist would sketch exactly what he saw on stage, and then go back and translate those sketches into both characters and sets of whatever play was being done.
My master, Prince Aladdin, would visit your majesty upon an important mission.
Aladdin? I do not know the name. But usher,
then you would add little pieces of velvet or leather for the boots. There are a lot of warriors and armored people and stuff like that. And then you'd mount them on little wire stands. So you had to do the voices, you had to do the manipulation, you could add music.
You hear this, daughter? What is your wish?
Lovely princess, pardon my presumption in aspiring to so much beauty.
The script for Aladdin and His Wonderful Lamp, based on one staged at the Theatre Royal Covent Garden in 1826, would be boiled down to its bare essentials.
Princess, I crave the honor of your hand.
I thank you, sir, but I must refuse.
Refuse? Unbelievable!
Inevitably, this performance of The Miller and His Men, for example, in your home, or Richard III, or The Tempest, or Sleeping Beauty, would reflect your own aesthetic choices.
That same do-it-yourself ethic is what attracts Great Small Works' Trudy Cohen to the toy theater form and led her to organize the 6th Toy Theater Festival in New York this winter.
What we're proposing is something that is making it very accessible and saying anyone can do it, and you can do it with a cardboard box and a crayon or a magazine. You can cut out a picture and animate it.
Miniaturized toy theater environments attract professional artists as well. Children's book illustrator Brian Selznick won the coveted Caldecott Prize in 2002 for The Dinosaurs of Waterhouse Hawkins. His toy theater production of the same story is a wordless poetic reverie on, of all things, the history of paleontology, staged in a series of antique wooden curio cabinets.
The book is a true story about this guy named Waterhouse Hawkins, who was an artist in the 1800s who designed the first life-size sculptures of dinosaurs before anybody knew what dinosaurs looked like. They just had a couple of fossils, a jawbone and a rib. And from those few pieces, they extrapolated out what they thought the rest of the creature looked like. I knew in the toy theater piece, I wanted there to be no words. I wanted everything to be told purely with images and with moving scenarios. There's certain very practical things about miniaturization because you have total control of what you're doing. And plus, at the time I was living in a very tiny apartment. And so it was really great to just be able to, I kind of knew that nothing could be larger than my desk that I was working on.
In his toy theater show, Selznick, a slender bearded man with a bashful demeanor, stands behind a scuffed wooden desk. He manipulates a tiny white bone mounted on a long wire so that it floats past a series of antique curio cabinets whose doors mysteriously swing open. The tiny tableau inside are projected by a video camera onto a screen mounted nearby, so the audience can see every minute detail.
We have a little bone who's kind of the star of the show. He appears and sort of guides us through the history of paleontology, and the bone is only about an inch long, I'd say. And there's three encyclopedias that are set up on the stage, which open by themselves and take us through what people thought fossils were. There's a little tiny curio cabinet, a curtain opens inside the curio cabinet, and then there's little tiny doors inside the curio cabinet that open, and inside all of that is the island of the dinosaurs, which is the moment where they are seeing the most gigantic thing ever, and it's tiny, it's little teeny tiny. I have two little paper Victorian women scream and faint when they finally see the dinosaurs, but the tiniest thing in the entire show is the dinosaur island. Because when things are that tiny, you kind of get lost in it. The whole show is about dinosaurs, which are gigantic. The act of making everything tiny became a nice comment on the giganticness of everything that I was talking about.
Because toy theater is so simple, so direct, so immediate, so intimate, it's a form that really lends itself for contemporary storytelling.
It points out the artificiality of the performance and invites you to make that real, saying, yeah, this is all fake, but, you know, join us in imagining it's real.
For Studio 360, I'm Deborah Cash.
I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360 today with the playwright David Ives. David, have you ever seen toy theater?
I've never seen the toy theater that they're talking about, but ironically, the first time I ever went to the theater was to see a production of Pinocchio that my mother took me to, which was a combination of live actors and puppets. I think it was probably a hugely traumatic experience for me. I'm obviously still recovering from it, but it must have done something because I'm in the theater. But that the theater that they were just talking about is not a kind of theater. I've seen some puppet theater. I used to watch the Bread and Puppet Theater quite a lot when they would come through. But this seems to be actual toys rather than puppets.
I think the it sounds as though the genre is expansive enough to accommodate both.
Just about anything. And it seems as if this may be something like the theater that Ingmar Bergman had when he was a kid that he talks about, that he shows in Fanny and Alexander, if you remember, which is based on his own experience, that as a child he was given, I suppose, a magic lantern theater, which was probably the equivalent of this sort of thing where you could show slides of famous shows. But I believe that for Ingmar Bergman in his lonely vicarage in the north of Sweden, it was probably Tristan and Isolde or Strindberg more likely. But I was wondering as I was listening, if you did toy theater with really sort of scatological or pornographic theater, and if that contrast wouldn't sort of point up an interesting contrast, because if you're doing toys with toy voices, the
cuteness,
the preciousness of it may destroy the effect you're trying to get, but it's a little hard to tell. But it seems to me that something to do the Marquis de Sade or something with toys might be something strange and interesting because
every child I know, once they get that Barbie with the clothes
off.
I
know, it's the same. Boys and girls, it's the same thing. Children are doing it everywhere. But it's that sort of, I don't know, it's the making something strange that seems to be part of what miniaturism is about.
David Ives is my guest today. I'm Kurt Anderson, and we are talking about miniatures. And in just a few moments, we'll hear some of the itty-bittiest musical sounds in the world. Stay with us in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360 today with the playwright David Ives, and we're talking about miniatures. There's part of this music that you probably can't hear. And if you're driving very fast in your car, you probably can't hear it at all. But it's there. This is microsound, music made out of tones that are very, very high or very, very low and or completely synthetic. The artists who make microsound think even tiny changes in what we hear can affect us. We asked three composers to tell us about their fascination with microsounds. Here are Dan Abrams, Steve Roden, and Taylor Dupree.
I think microsound came from computer software generated music. So it, you know, sort of began as an exploration, taking one sound and getting inside that sound and tearing that sound apart and keep going inwards.
It's a type of music that's based off of bringing sound elements down to irreducible primaries.
I think the term microsound, in a broadest sense, has to do with listening to sound in terms of details.
My name's Taylor Dupree, and I run the 12K label in Brooklyn, New York. You know, I've always wanted to use technology for what it was best for, and that was, to me, exploring ultra-synthetic sound. My first real experience, like, intentional experience, came pretty late when I heard Ryoji Ikeda's Plus Minus CD. It was like, wow, this is so different, you know, because it was just sine waves and just a lot of empty space. Those kind of sounds have become the palette of microsound, super high sine waves and deep subsonic basses. And it's just that, it's a palette that a lot of people use. It's no different than rock music, guitar, drums, bass palette. You know, and there's a lot you can do with a guitar and a drum set, and there's just as much you can do with a, you know, high sine wave and a low sine wave. Steve Roden always never fails to impress me, just because he's doing sort of what we're all doing, but in a very hands-on, literally hands-on way. Steve's just using microphones and found objects.
My name is Steve Roden. I am a visual and sound artist. For me, the process of making work has to involve a kind of tactile experience. Even the kinds of sounds that I want to use have to have some kind of physical presence, as though they originally came from something in the world. I was invited to do a sound installation in a library space, which obviously was a less than traditional idea in terms of being in a space where everybody keeps shushing you and telling you to be quiet. I wanted to use the sounds of book pages being handled to generate a composition that could exist in the space and interact with the space in a way that wouldn't distract people who were reading, but perhaps maybe they would notice it when they were sitting there listening, if anybody goes to the library to listen. Simply took these recordings that I made of myself fondling book pages and processed them with a sampler, basically by either slowing the sounds down or speeding the sounds up, and then fragmenting those sounds and looping them. I don't like the way the computer kind of tends to smooth things out. I mean, I think it still has an overall specific kind of sound environment that it exists in because these sounds never existed in the world.
My name is Dan Abrams, aka Shuttle358, and I write microsound music. I tend to bridge together maybe the less listenable experimental music with maybe the older, you know, melodic ambient music. I always feel like there's a bridge. You have to put the two together and still create something that can be listened to very easily and that contains elements of new ideas. People are so obsessed with throwing out conventions and creating something new and taking big steps. I mean, big steps with this music. I mean, this isn't a small new style of music you're going to hear on MTV like next year's, you know, Flavor or whatever. I mean, this is a big deal. Now, because it's such a big deal, not all of it's going to be perfect. I mean, that's the nature of experimental music or experimental anything. The misconception is that there is no emotion in it, and that's wrong. There is. There can be. There are people that are putting warm classical music, like Murkoff, who's based down in Tijuana. This genre has made me think a little bit about the way people listen to music and the way people listen in general in the world. I'm kind of fascinated when I go to a movie theater here in Los Angeles and I see several hundred people, like on an opening night, just sit quietly. It kind of is the same idea. I mean, can we get people to listen, to be quiet, to just be peaceful and enjoy and think about it? I mean, just to appreciate small, simplistic things in the world.
Taylor Dupree's new album is called Still. Dan Abrams, a.k.a. Shuttle358, also has a new album, Understanding Wildlife. And Steve Roden's book and CD collection, Resonances, was released in April. Michael Raphael produced our story. I'm Kurt Anderson. My guest today is David Ives, the writer of very short plays and long ones, too. Our subject is miniatures. And those sounds, that music, seems to me to get into a different realm of the miniature, which is not in time or space or any of those conventional dimensions, but it is miniature. It strikes me that it qualifies for our conversation in that it does what you said earlier miniatures so often do, which is demand that we pay close attention.
Right. I think this is sort of in the tradition of the meditational art form. I think actually the sort of advance of Eastern religion in the general population has made for people being more open to this sort of experience. If you played that for the average listener or 25 people out on the street, if they would classify that as music or just as sound, I don't know, because I think it's hard to tell how that sound is ordered into music for me, just listening to that. Because it seems to me that music is, by definition, ordered sound in some way. And the sort of random feeling of it makes it sound like sound more than music.
Which has been said about experimental music for the last 70 years.
Yeah. And, the classic statement of this was John Cage in, 1954 or something, with 4 minutes and 33 seconds, the great piece in which a pianist sits at a piano and does nothing and then stands up and goes away. And it forces you to hear your ambient sound and your environment as music instead of as silence. It's also a piece known as Silence just because John Cage's point was there is no such thing as silence. And, the Second Vienna School certainly has a tradition of this. You know, Webern and Schoenberg wrote pieces that were 25 seconds long, those great pieces by Schoenberg that are sometimes one of them is 19 seconds long, I think.
And which is often as much as you want to hear of Schoenberg.
That is the problem.
Another kind of miniaturism we haven't talked about today, somebody, for instance, a writer who is often called a miniaturist, is the novelist Nicholson Baker, whose books aren't particularly short, but whose sort of obsessive, manic, scrupulous detail. He wrote an entire book called The Mezzanine about every detail of a lunch hour. And again, I find this obsessive sort of microscopic focus on detail, I find very alluring, even though nothing happens.
Right. Well, there's a kind of it sort of fetishizes every moment of your existence and brings you down. It's that change of perspective that I was talking about. It's simply it's as if you're looking through a telescope the other way around. And what's on the—he makes the colors on the other end through his prose so compelling that you are forced to look. You know, along those same lines, it's, you know, Wagner is often thought of as a huge bombastic composer. I mean, the Ring cycle is, what, 12 hours long? And yet, I think it was Nietzsche who referred to Wagner as a great miniaturist because within that huge fabric there were these tiny melodies, and it was all built of these exquisite melodies that repeated and came back in patterns, so that there is a kind of miniaturism in the hugeness. But a miniaturist like Nicholson Baker makes the tininess of our – he's both showing up, sending up the tininess of our lives and celebrating the beauty of life. And I think that that's why something like The Mezzanine or his new book is such a good statement, because that is the tension within the work between – banality and beauty.
You have written long plays and full-length musicals and several dozen short plays. Is it just more fun to work at, you know, small scale in miniature?
It is certainly more fun in the sense that you get to sit up usually for one very long night and be inspired, which is how most of those little plays got written.
So it's art like it's supposed to be.
It is. Art off the seat of your pants and the top of your head. So it is, yes, there's a kind of exhilaration to knowing that whatever idea you've attacked is just a spark, and you're chasing that spark for as long as it's brilliant. And so that's
no quagmires,
no chance for a quagmire. That all comes in the rewrites and rehearsal.
David Ives, thank you for joining me today in Studio 360.
Thank you for having me on.
The playwright David Ives is the author of many short plays. His series of short plays called Time Flies, which is wonderful, will be at the Globe Theater in San Diego through September 7th. To find out more about him and anything else you heard on the show today, check out our website, studio360.org. To close the show today, we're taking something that usually comes in small bits, a pat, a teaspoon, a tablespoon, and making it big, as in the size of a Minnesota State Fair dairy princess. Before I confuse you any further, I am talking about the annual butter sculptures at the Minnesota State Fair in St. Paul. Every year, 12 young women are selected as dairy princesses based on their knowledge of the dairy industry and the fact that they live on farms in Minnesota. One woman is selected as Princess K of the Milky Way, but every finalist gets to step into a big plexiglass refrigerator, sit in front of people in a winter coat on a stool, and have her head sculpted out of a 90-pound block of butter.
It's an octagonal cooler with a 7-foot diameter, and the floor is revolving, and there's a crowd out there watching. And right now, I'm trying to get the plastic off this 90-pound block of butter. I'm Linda Christensen. I've been doing butter sculpture here. This is my 32nd year.
Hello, my name is Jessica Felling. I'm from Stearns County, where I live in Sauk Center, where my family milks about 500 dairy cows. The first time I saw the butterheads, I think I was about 9 years old, and my aunt and uncle brought me here to the state fair, and I was just amazed by it. I never imagined I'd be here getting it done.
Actually, butter is probably the best medium that I can work with. I worked with clay quite a bit, and still do, but it drags on your tools in a way that butter doesn't. The butter, particularly when it's salted, salt seems to make a difference. The butter just comes, you can dry your tools through so smoothly, and it gets such a nice surface. I would guess, what was that, maybe 3 pounds right there that I sliced off and threw in this bucket. This isn't really serious sculpture, obviously, but Minnesotans are very proud of this crazy tradition, this butter sculpture. Now I'm going to take my gloves off and open the door and let a little warm air in here. And the surface should get just enough of a melt to it that I can smooth this down with my hands fairly easily. I can just feel that my fingers slide on that little surface of butter, warm butter. Okay, there you are.
Wow. It looks a lot like me. It does. It's kind of scaring me, though, because I've never had anything like this happen to me. I think that is the most asked question of every Dairy Princess. What are you going to do with your sculpture? I'm not quite sure what I'm doing with mine, but I'll probably donate it if there's any community events, or I'll give it to family and friends. And I love to cook, so I'm sure I'll bake with it a lot. And I definitely don't want to just save it. I want to use it up because it's butter, and it shouldn't be wasted.
This year's Minnesota State Fair ends on Labor Day. Our story was produced by the Minnesotan, Steve Nelson. Studio 360 is produced by WNYC along with PRI, Public Radio International. The production team includes
Julie Burstein,
Carrie Hillman,
Peter Clowney,
David Krasnow,
Lital Mulad,
Ave Carrillo,
Michelle Siegel,
Rob Weisberg,
Sarah Lilly,
Andy Lancet,
Gardner Allen,
Michael Rayfield,
Trent Wolby,
John H. Stanek III.
Our theme music was composed by David Van Tegum. I'm Kurt Anderson, and I do hope you'll join us next week here in Studio 360.
Studio 360 is a co-production of Public Radio International and WNYC New York, and is funded in part by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, and the National Endowment for the Arts, and by donors to PRI's Producers Forum, who include Dr. Claire Gaudiani and Christopher and Elizabeth Sullivan.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360...
An event like this places us all in front of a void.
How do we memorialize loss?
The process of working does not change the death, but it does use that material in a way that isn't itself to be an object of beauty.
I'm Kurt Anderson. Join me for a look at memorials. Next time in Studio 360 from PRI.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.